tomorrow night, sorry, tonight, we have the Brandon Paul Research.
I want to say just a word or two about the delegates who are here, and we have almost everyone from the United States, but we have people from Australia, we have people from India, and we have one individual, he's from the Faroe Islands, from Norway, so that's a pretty good dedication to come to those distances, and thank you for coming. But I explained to the hotel staff that we had a meeting before the conference about how this development worked, that if they saw some really hairy, rough-looking, loud characters, especially late at night in the bar, they were Canadians. Yeah, this is prove a point. All the Canadians, you know, just stand up for a second. Hey, there they are. And I made that introduction as a way of also introducing Stephen Downs, who's also hairy and rough-looking and Canadian. Stephen Downs is, I think, Canada's gift to the e-learning industry. Our taxes pay for him. He's a senior researcher of the National Research Council of Canada. And my work of doing research on what's coming out in learning technologies is immensely helped by the fact that I read Stephen's newsletter blog on a daily basis. And he's one of the hardest working people I know in terms of this industry. He puts out a daily newsletter, and that requires a huge amount of dedication. And many of you know Stephen just from that. So here's Stephen Downs.
Hi, everyone. Speaking of cats and tails, this is my first time using this little conference recording device, so I don't know if it's going to work. But have a recording device of some sort. If you like recording it, by all means, please feel free. I may be calling on you later for the audio of this. A second thing, and I'm not sure how, I don't even know which slide is going to come on. I was here yesterday getting ready for this talk and, you know, check out the room, which of course they changed for this morning, but checking out the room, and they said, well, there'll be two screens, and I sort of went, oh, two screens? Well, then we can have a back channel, can't we? And I said, what's that? And so I explained that I can have my slides on one of the screens. Oh, those are my pictures. Cool. Never mind. Oh, man. Talk about living on the edge. No, they're mostly okay. And right now it's coming up blank. What should be over there, I'll quickly write up the script so that we can have a conversation during this talk, because that'll give you something else to watch besides the slides and besides me. So once that comes up, and I'm sincerely hoping it will come up, there will be a back channel, and there will be an address, a URL on the screen when it comes up, and if you open that URL in your browser, I hope you all brought your computers with you, knowing that there was wireless at this talk. And if you didn't, well, you should have, because you're going to miss out, unless it doesn't come up, of course. And just type in your comment, and what will happen is you type in your comment, hit submit, your comment will show up on that screen. So that's how this is supposed to work. Now, right now it's a little dark. I should have chosen a color scheme other than black on black. So we'll see what happens with that. So if that pops up sometime during the talk, you can start taking part in that. I've got a very ambitious talk and not very much time to do it in. I guess they want me to do it by quarter two, right? Be out of here by quarter two, so that's like half the time. I thought it could be worse, though. I thought this talk is starting at 9:30, so I come toodling in, you know, 8 o'clock. Yeah, I got lots of time. That's another cat. If you want the slides for this talk, I've posted them on a site called SlideShare. You can see the address there. It'll be the talk with the screen that you just saw. I ask you not to download the actual slides right now because they're 9 megabyte slides. There's no way to really compress them in a Macintosh. and so you'll kill wireless for everybody. But you should be able to look at the SlideShare version okay, and that should show up without too much of a problem. I want to talk about e-learning, of course. That's why we're all here. I want to talk a little bit about the traditional approach to e-learning. I especially want to talk about the alternative approach to e-learning. Okay, well, that's pretty good, except we got a bit of a sizing issue here. Okay. Cat tail. This will be really good once it gets going. And actually, this is kind of fun because don't use that URL. It'll just please don't use that URL. Use the big one that shows up on the screen there once we get it going. I think it would be kind of neat if we can talk the other keynotes into having something like this so that we can comment during their talks as well. Jay, what do you say? Yeah, for it. I want to talk about Web 2.0, e-learning 2.0, and I want to talk about what is probably going to be the thing that replaces your learning management system, something called the personal learning environment. And it's not an application, it's a concept. And one day it may be an application or maybe not, who knows. I'm going to begin by e-learning and development. Just as an aside, I've never seen this before. They have hermit crabs in little helmets for sale at the mall. You just never know what you're going to see when you get out there. I think there's a lesson in that. Look, online learning's been around for quite a while, right? We're pretty familiar with it by now. It has really grown with the advent of the World Wide Web. Brendan talked a bit about the CD, but really I think it was the World Wide Web that brought online learning into the fore. And there have been many developments in the last few years. Developments like open source applications that are supporting online learning. Open source learning management systems such as Sakai and Moodle and Boddington and A-Tutor. Development and community tools like LAMS, Connections, ELGG and the rest. And of course the whole range of supporting software including Firefox and Thunderbird, these wonderful open source software applications. They were using Internet Explorer on that computer. I told them they should use Firefox. We've seen a lot of open educational resources recently. Everybody has heard, I'm sure, of MIT's Open Courseware Project, and they have launched something called the Open Courseware Consortium. And the objective of these programs is very laudable, is to make e-learning materials freely available to everybody in the world. Those of you who are involved in developing e-learning materials commercially certainly want to take note of this sort of potential for competition. We have the Open University providing entire courses online. Again, open courses, free access, open education resource initiatives that are being sponsored by foundations such as Hewlett or the Wellcome Trust, and international organizations such as OECD and UNESCO. And of course, Creative Commons. How many of you have heard of Creative Commons? Almost, well, well, I saw 20% of you had raised your hands. The rest of you don't really. Oh, it works. Awesome. So I hope you all caught that URL. But if you didn't, it's okay, because once it runs out of comments, then it displays the URL again. So, although any mouse anonymous, get it, may monopolize this. There it is. Get it down now while you can, because then it'll go away and people will comment again. Creative Commons is a way of licensing your educational resources, allowing other people to use those resources, remix those resources, abuse those resources, and for free. It's a way of licensing your material so other people can do it, with the express intent of having other people do it. If you look at my website, you'll find that everything is licensed under Creative Commons. And what I'm saying by that license is, take this stuff, do something interesting with it, and give it to the world. It's a totally different model. We're looking at new environments. We've been looking over the last year or so at the multimedia explosion, YouTube, SlideShare. Is there anybody out there, I love these bright lights, anybody out there actually looking at the SlideShare version of the slides? Nobody? Oh, somebody way in the back. Is it working? Yes, excellent. That's another cat successfully tailed. That's an interesting expression. I don't even want to, never mind. Mobile computing, PDAs, and things like that. Not so much so in Canada as in other places, because we have very expensive mobile computing in Canada, which is unfortunate. And of course, the 3D web, we're just beginning to see that with things like Second Life. There's an open source application coming out called Croquette, which is an awful pronunciation of a great word, which is open source, three-dimensional online world. Oops, too many. Previous. Thank you. And of course, access has opened up tremendously over the last few years with one-to-one computing in the schools, which is the very, we now know, very successful main laptop project, the One Laptop Per Child initiative. And if you were following the news yesterday, they just announced that the EXO computer, which is the computer behind the One Laptop Per Child initiative, will be available for sale in Canada and the U.S. on a one-for-two basis. You buy two computers, you get one, and only OLPC could pull that off. And if you're wondering what happens to the other computer, it gets sent to a child somewhere in the developing world. And of course, wireless access. We have 3G network, we have WLAN. I'm waiting for WiMAX to really hit. WiMAX is long-range broadband wireless access. And I think this is going to revolutionize wireless access, especially in urban areas. So that's the backdrop. We've lived through in the last 10 years a lifetime of developments. And now, as I like to say it sometimes, we have successfully managed to emulate the classroom on the computer. And what I mean by that is the work that we've done in e-learning thus far has followed a very traditional, very predictable pattern, which I call the traditional AI approach. It's the old wired approach. It's the old distance learning approach. Basically, the model that people are using for this approach is the expert system. And the idea of the expert system is that you have a representation of the world, a model of the world, a whole bunch of statements. In RDF, they call that the semantic web. And then you have an inference engine that operates rules over that representational state. And the way to think of that, just in terms of your own life, is the wizard. No, I don't mean Gandalf. I mean the wizard that you might get with Microsoft Word or some other programs, right? It takes you step by step by step through some sort of process. Very useful in some circumstances, but in others very limited. Expert systems are very goal-oriented. If you want to configure your wireless so that it works, an expert system is the way to go. Expert systems are efficient, or they should be, and they should be adaptive. But expert systems have a lot of overhead. They require knowledge acquisition. You have to have a model, a whole model of the world, in the computer to begin with, which means that you need subject matter experts putting this content into the system. You need the knowledge representation, so you need designers and programmers and all of that to represent that knowledge in some way, and then to encode it, to create the rules in order to step through this knowledge. It's a very labor-intensive process. Those of you who are developing e-learning now, you know about the work that's involved in developing e-learning solutions. See, I knew this would be more interesting than me. That's why we do it, though. It's funny because this is the first time I've done this, right? This really messes you up when you're speaking because, of course, like any other speaker, I'm trying to read your reactions, right? Am I on target? I say something and then everybody cracks up and that was a straight line. He's got a hobby. Yes. Learning design, many of you will have heard of learning design. Learning design is the AI approach personified, where you're stepping through the presentation of a series of learning resources punctuated from time to time by tasks and decisions. So it's a whole decision tree sort of approach. IMS learning design is based on the educational modeling language, and I'm sure that particular designation is deliberate. It was created by Rob Koper, of course, in the Netherlands. We've seen that kind of example before, programmed instruction, where you're playing roles in educational scenario. You make a decision, something gets presented. You make a different decision, something different gets presented. The idea here, says Rob Koper, is that learning design is pedagogically neutral, but it's still the idea that learning consists of this artificial intelligence approach, where you have all of your knowledge represented, and you're going to transfer this knowledge from one person to another. It's like knowledge as a truck. What we're seeing coming now down the pipe, Rob Koper's working on this, Wayne Hodgins is working on this, all of the people who've been doing learning objects and learning object standards, they're all working now on competency-based learning or competence-based learning, depending on who you talk to. And so now they're going to represent all of the competences and put that into the knowledge base as well. What that's going to do, of course, is create more intelligent, we hope, decision trees, so that we're working on competences as well as roles, as well as content, as well as representations of the world. And if you can imagine how much effort it's going to take to program all of those competences into all of those knowledge systems, you can imagine how much overhead is going to be required here. So we've got a whole bunch of learning design tools and a few... nobody? Oh, there we go. Competence. See, I should have that in front of me, so I should... Never mind. But it's more interesting, don't you think, if I can't see what's being said? If you get these slides later on, you can download or access any of these websites that are presenting the new learning design tools. And, of course, it's all based on the Lego metaphor. And you know, it's sort of hard to get your mind wrapped around this, but, you know, because all of these things come in together and they all play a different role in the same sort of picture. Here we have this Lego metaphor where knowledge is composed of all of these little parts, and we put all of these little parts together and we get some kind of whole, and then once we've assembled the right kind of whole, we're going to package it up and then we're going to deliver it to somebody, and that's what we call e-learning. It's like a refinery, isn't it? It's like this elemental thing where we're taking this knowledge and boiling it down and processing it, and then we're going to fire it out there at people. I mean, yeah, fire it out there at people. So that's the picture of traditional e-learning. And that is the picture that I argue, and argue here in this talk, is the wrong picture. That is traditional learning now placed online. And where we are going, I argue, is to a new picture, which is sometimes called connectivism. It's what I call, sometimes I call it e-learning 2.0. Sometimes I call it learning networks. If learning design is all organized and structured and everything's in neat little boxes, connectionism and connectivism is like massive random scribbles. It has its origins in computational theories proposed by people like Seymour Papert and Martin Gominsky and others. And the idea here is, instead of a representation of the world in code, in language, in neat little boxes with inference rules, rather a representation of the world is very messy. There are no words, there are no rules. All there is this network of interconnected, neurons, units, crickets, it doesn't matter, as long as the things are interconnected. Which means that the first theme that emerges in the connectionist or connectivist alternative is the unorganized, unmanaged, unstructured, as in unconference, unworkshop, un-everything. The new alternative is messy, and that's what makes it difficult for people to get their hands on. This talk is messy. Well, you should be commenting more. Maybe it's too neat. Maybe I should be more random in my talk so that you'll talk up there. So I'll be curious to find out after talking to you after how this worked. I would have expected more comments. I left it to 10 seconds per comment, and I'm sitting there thinking, is that long enough? And I thought, well, maybe I should make it 5 seconds. Messy is cool, but I get distracted easily. Okay. It's not content produced by subject matter experts, by content houses producing large overhead representations of the world, but rather it's a system based on what we call sometimes user-generated content. If the old picture is content, learning as content, learning as like a library, like books, like boxes, this new model depicts learning and content as flow. In other words, thinking of learning materials not as something that you have on your shelf, but learning materials that are just simply accessible, accessed as you need them. The picture that I want, what I'm trying to do is sort of foster a mental image in your mind. We think our traditional picture of knowledge is, you know, like laws of nature, universal, all cats are mammals, all apples are red, things like that. Categories, taxonomies, and you think of all the taxonomies that you've learning about education. That's the old way of representing a domain of knowledge. The new way of representing a domain of knowledge is of patterns of connectivity in an unstructured environment, where instead of sentences and categories and rules and syntax, rather you're presented with a perception, a phenomenon, or a set of phenomena, and you recognize patterns in that phenomena. I like to talk to people, I don't think I have this slide up here, people ask me, well, what is knowledge like? And you know, I have a background in philosophy, so they expect me to have an answer to that question, which I think is pretty funny. But the answer I give them is, knowledge is like knowing where Waldo is. How many of you are familiar with Where's Waldo? Right. And many of you have actually found Waldo, right? I'm assuming there's a few people out there. I never did. It's like those magic images where you see the 3D. I can't do it. They say there's 3D images. I go, there's no way. It's a great trick that all the newspapers in the world are pulling just on me. So anyhow, there's probably people out there still looking for Waldo. But those of you who have found Waldo, now, you look at the picture, and you can't unfind him, can you? Like, once you've found him, you've found him. Once you see him, he's there. Knowledge is like that. It's like not being able to recognize... Behave! okay, there's somebody who's familiar with Russellian philosophy. You might ask, okay, well, how do you get knowledge at all in this web of connections and neurons and things like that? And the idea here is that a concept like a tree is represented not with a symbol, but rather with a pattern that is spread out throughout the network. So as you can see in this diagram here, we've got the red might be the pattern of connections that's activated on the perception of a tree. And when you perceive trees, each time you perceive a tree, it will create a similar pattern of perceptions. And so you begin to recognize that. It's kind of like seeing Waldo, right? Instead you're seeing a tree. And so you begin to recognize, oh yeah, this is familiar. And what it is the same pattern of connections between your neurons is being stimulated each time you see one of these things. Now what's really neat, although really messy, is that you can use the same network, the exact same network, to encode patterns of connectivity for different types of phenomena. So we have a tree, a cute little puppy dog, and a sofa, and as you can see, each one of those creates a pattern inside that same single network. And the reason why this is messy, and the reason why traditional semantics breaks down, is because our perception of the puppy changes our concept of the tree. And the reason for that is each time we see another puppy, it changes the network that we're using to represent the concept of a tree. It makes no sense. How can our perception of a puppy change what we think of as a tree? Well, it does that simply because we're using the same neural net to represent the same kind of thing. And what happens when you push that, if you push that picture and you apply it to things like words and sentences and the stuff that we know about, we think we have a handle on it, we can see that a picture of representation of the world composed of words and sentences breaks down very quickly. I'll give you a quick example. I've used this example many times. I love this example. I overuse it. Think of the word Paris. Okay? Everybody has a concept of Paris, right? If the representation picture is right, if traditional AI is right, everybody thought of the same thing when they thought of Paris. If that picture is right. Okay, how many of you thought of the city? Yeah. Good bunch of you, though I'll assume the rest of you who didn't raise your hands are lying. Knowledge is cool. There's your colleagues. How many of you thought of Paris Hilton? How many of you thought of Plaster of Paris? Yeah, I always think of Plaster of Paris. That's why I'm so different. The left bank. How many of you thought of France? How many of you thought of a cute little puppy dog? You see, when you think of Paris as a simple concept, everybody knows what Paris is, but if we sat down and analyzed what each one of you thinks of Paris, it's a different picture for each one of you. Because you've all had different experiences, and your neural nets are all set up slightly different. So when I say something like, Paris is the capital of France, there's about 450 of you, I've just created 450 separate representations. One for each one of your neural nets, plus one for me. You set 451 there. And we know how this stuff works. We know how networks work. We know how patterns are created in the mind. This is a rough, quick set of three ways that we can create connections between neurons. Plain, ordinary, heavy, and associationism. If two things always appear at the same time, we draw a connection between them. It's kind of like cause and effect. So we invent it. Backpropagation is a technical term for a model that's used in computer science, specifically connectionism. If you look at people like Rummelhart and McClellan, you'll find this. And basically, we get a perception in, the connections are formed, and then we get stuff out the outside, out the other end, and we can send a signal back in, depending on whether we liked what came out the other end or not. And then there's a third mechanism called a Boltzmann mechanism that is based on the network of connections trying to settle in to its most comfortable and most stable position. Think of it, you know, you throw a rock into a pond of water, the pond of water eventually settles out so it's all flat. That's kind of the way the Boltzmann mechanism works. Told you it might crash. That's what happens when you create something that... Oh, it's a screensaver. Never mind. That's even better. Oh, man. I missed what was probably a really good comment. I have no idea why the apostrophes are doing that. It's... I tested this on Firefox and they all worked fine. Okay. How do we get at the semantics of this stuff? This can be messy. By the semantics, what I mean is you take a network, a messy network composed of connections and neurons that appears to have no meaning whatsoever. You hold a brain in your hand and either you're in a Hamlet play or there's no meaning in that brain. And how do you get meaning out of these connections? Well, the way to understand this is to look at how different kinds of networks work and how other times don't work. We can think, imagine the network of lemmings. Pretend that lemmings communicate with each other. I assume that they probably do. But what happens in the lemming community is they all communicate and one lemming gets the bright idea, let's jump off the cliff. And all the lemmings go ahead and do that. That is a network that is not working well. Right. Now, I've completely made up the biology of lemmings, so we'll just pretend that that was a real example and not a fake example. But the idea here is that you can have networks that create what are called cascade phenomena. And basically what happens here is a network will overreact one way or another. Another example of a network, for example, is the network of human beings thought of as carriers of disease. And you've probably seen all those pictures, right? You know, one person interact with another, interact with another. And what happens is, in a cascade phenomenon, everybody catches the disease and they all die. And this is a bad thing. But if you structure the network right, even if you have disease in your society, not everybody gets it. You may recall the Ebola outbreak a number of years back. The Ebola outbreak of the Ebola virus happened in a community in Africa, in the Congo, as I recall. And very contagious virus, very deadly virus. If it had broken out in New York City, we might have had a very different result. But the thing is, the way the network was structured is we were able to contain the Ebola virus so it didn't spread throughout society. So sometimes something like a virus will spread throughout society, other times it won't. So we're able to actually think of different kinds of network in terms of how quickly or how poorly something propagates through them. You've probably all heard of memes and ideas that spread across the internet. That's the same sort of thing happening. And what you want is a mechanism whereby an idea can make its way across the network, but not in such a way that it very quickly overwhelms the whole network. Those sorts of considerations applied to the design of networks give us the picture of network semantics. Now, I've been thinking about this and thinking about it too long, according to my computer. And we can contrast network theory with traditional AI theory by contrasting between groups and networks. And you've all had plenty of time to read this slide. The group is the traditional AI learning as usual picture, and the network is the learning as e-learning 2.0 picture. And the traditional way we think of it, we think of groups, we think of collaboration, we think of schools, of classes, of categories. In fact, we've practically defined learning that way, and sort of even wonder, can we even think of learning without classes? Can we even think of learning without schools? $20. Never mind. I am way too easily distracted, too. We think of groups as elemental. Groups is defined by sameness. Groups as defined in terms of number. But by contrast, a network is diverse. It's changing. If groups are like metals, like sulfur or lead or gold, networks are like ecosystems, like forests and jungles and lakes and ponds. And the idea here is that in a network, even though everything is messy, even though everything is disorganized and unmanaged and different and diverse, we still get order out of that system created by the interactions among the members. And this is what creates what I call the semantic principle. And the semantic principle defines not simply how networks function in such a way as to, not bad, eh? In function in such a way as to not create cascade phenomena, but also define how we should be designing and looking at and selecting our e-learning applications in the future. And there's four basic principles. The first principle is diversity. You want applications, you want a network in which each of the members is able to be, and indeed encouraged to be, different. You want autonomy. You want the individuals in that network to be making their own decisions based on their own criteria. As John Stuart Mill said, each pursuing their own good in their own way. You want openness. You want, and by this I mean not just the free sharing of materials, but I do mean that, but also allowing people who are using different systems, people who are using different applications, people with different sorts of ideas, to be able to contribute to the content of that network, and you want interaction. How often have you heard, if you're in a company or something like that, we should all be marching to the same drummer. We should all, you know, carry the consistency of message. Speak as if with one voice. In network, you don't do that. Each person speaks with their own voice, and if there is something that's created in the network, it's created by the interaction, not by the selection of one voice that will be representative of everybody. Networks are connected. Networks are connected peer-to-peer, one person to another person. You don't have one person who is the broadcaster. Like this talk here, exactly the opposite of network, right? You have me and I'm broadcasting. I'm trying to create more of a network, and I got an X. Oh well. Every time I look up there, I don't know what I'm going to see. But we get trying to create more of a network by creating more interactions among people, and that's one way of doing it. Conversation. Interacting back and forth. Distributive. The voice in this room isn't just me. It should be each and all of you. And emergent. If there's a meaning that comes out of this session, it's not simply the meaning that I had when I stood up here, but the meaning that emerges by me and each one of you all speaking at whatever that is. Well, we don't know what that's going to be ahead of time. Cats and tails. Why networks? Because networks are more... about humans are more like networks. Why networks? Because networks can be more than any given individual within the network. Why networks? Because the knowledge that's created in a network is more reliable than and more complex than the knowledge that's created in the more traditional way. I'm very briefly going to go through the core technologies that characterize Web 2.0. These core technologies now should be thought of from the perspective of enabling networks, as I've described them so far. The first of these is social networking. This is where each person is able to define a list of other people that they will connect with. And that creates that peer-to-peer, person-to-person conversation. The second thing is tagging. Tagging is a technology that allows you to put or create your own category for a resource. Each person creates their own tags independently and not according to some standard vocabulary. AJAX is a way of allowing a website to communicate with a server. And what this does is it creates, well, maybe not that exactly, but it creates websites that allow people to create and have conversations with each other. REST is a way of having one website talk to another website. It's a way of very simply and efficiently creating this whole web of data, connecting one website to another website to another website. The application program interface is another example of this, and the mashup, and you may have seen some of these, combining different services, combining maps with GPSs, with pictures, with text, and creating new things out of the connections of multiple applications. JavaScript object notation. This is, for those of you who are technically inclined, a way of getting the getting past domain restrictions. It's a way for one website to put content onto another website. OpenID. If you haven't been following OpenID yet, you should follow OpenID. It's a way for a person to have a persistent identity, their own identity, that travels from website to website to website. Instead of Yahoo, who are across the road, I wanted to complain to them earlier, instead of Yahoo telling you who you are, that's why I wanted to complain to them, you define who you are, and you go to Yahoo and say, I am so-and-so, instead of them saying, you are so-and-so. See how the difference, it flips around. The idea here in the Web 2.0 world is no more walled gardens, no more web services based on a single website or a single agency. If you're looking at this in the educational world, traditionally the way we've always done it is our learning management systems are run by an institution, and you subscribe to that institution, and you take their courses, and you have their ID number and all of that. But in the future, learning will be from many different institutions at the same time, and you'll access learning resources as you need them from whoever can provide them. And you won't be a University of Alberta student or a Dalhousie University student. You will simply be a student taking a course from the U of A, a course from Dal, a course from wherever. And that gives us e-learning 2.0. And I'm conscious that I'm running out of time here. So I'm just going to very quickly summarize e-learning 2.0 and then wrap it up. E-learning 2.0 is at heart the idea that learning is not based on objects and contents as though they were stored in a library. Rather, it is the idea that learning is something that flows, something that is like tap water or like electricity. It's like having information, ambience, available as you need it, and available in such a way that you can learn when and as you need to learn. The idea here is that people learn the same way that networks learn, and as networks learn, so do people learn. They are both complex systems. They both depend on the connections. Learning yourself is the same as the network learning. As you interact with the network, you are also creating your own internal network. The idea here is that it's learner-centered. You are at the center, and all the rest of the world is out there, and you are interacting with it on a peer-to-peer, one-to-one basis as necessary. The learning is not owned by the university, it's not owned by the government, it's not owned by a corporation, it is owned by you, the learner. And the learning is not something that is delivered to you, like a truck, it's something that you build and you create as a consequence of all of those interactions. Learning is immersive. Learning is something that you get by doing. It's not the stacking up of contents in your head, but it's you doing things, interacting. And what happens is, as you do things, as you interact, what you are doing is you are building this network of connections in your mind. What is it to know? It is to have a certain state of connectivity in your mind. What is it to learn? It is to acquire that state of connectivity through actions, through practices, through reflection. It's connected. It connects you with the rest of the world. It connects you with other students. Learning is the conversation and the interaction. And again, it's not the content of these things. We don't care about the content. Well, maybe a little, but not much. It's the actual act or practice of having these conversations that creates the learning. Game-based learning, getting there, getting immersed into a situation. Workflow learning, Jay Cross will talk to you about that, where the learning, I assume he'll talk to you about that. He won't talk to you about that. He'll look it up on his site. Where the learning is immersed right in the work that you're doing. Mobile learning. I tell people, the best place to learn about trees is in a forest. And you go out there, and you get in there and among the trees, and that's how you learn about trees. So we're at this crossroads, or we're at this point in time where we've built this whole great artifice, traditional learning, learning based on objects and contents and rules and representations and authorities and classes and categories, and we've realized, or we should realize by now, that that is a great big house of cards, and it is not a model of what we learn or how we learn. And as the web begins to change, and as we begin to see these new Web 2.0 technologies and e-learning 2.0 technologies, we're beginning to see that learning isn't about pushing contents at people. It's about creating environments, creating situations, creating possibilities of perception for people so that they can take this and mix it and build their own learning for themselves. I'm going to stop on that note, and I thank you very much for your time and your attention.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a wonderful thought. And one of the things we did when we organized this conference, we actually read a thesis while we were in the conference. And one of his suggestions is that you have a bullpen or an area for people who are just filling out conversations. What we found out in the lobby, I don't even think you know this, but in the lobby there's a whole set of sofas and a cord around it that says, meet the speakers, and Stephen's going to go there now. And
if you want to talk to him, that's a good place to sit down on a sofa and have a conversation or any other time during the day. All the other speakers are in the room. If you wish, after your session, to just sit down and talk with people who were in your session for further conversation, that's the area. Just simply tell people to meet you in the speakers area and to set up the next 2 days for that purpose. Thank you very much. What we're going to do is just move the sessions to 10 per session. We have still have a coffee break. This room, nothing's happening except the shootouts are being set up. When you have coffee, you can come back in here and see the beginning of the shootouts. At lunchtime, you can be here for about a half an hour.